Okay, I'll call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order and let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:36 p.m. on Monday, May 1st, 2023. Present today, we've got Representative Josephson, Representative Hannon, Representative Galvin, Representative Stapp, Representative Co-Chair Edgman, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Kronk, Representative Ortiz, Representative Cologne, myself, Co-Chair Foster, and just a reminder, folks can mute their cell phones. Today we'll hear, we've got three bills before us today. And those are, or maybe just two? Two, you're right. HB 66, which is controlled substances, and then HB 28, which is access to marijuana conviction records. So first, we'll take public testimony and questions from the departments and agencies on both House Bill 66, fentanyl bill, and HB 28, the marijuana bill, conviction records. First up will be HB 66. We'll hear from the Department of Law, Criminal Division, and Public Defender's Office, and the courts. We'll have a brief recap of the bill from Department of Law. Online is Deputy Attorney General John Skidmore. So with that, Mr. Skidmore, if you could please place yourself on the record and provide a brief recap of the bill. And then after that, we'll take questions from the committee. And then, Mr. Skidmore, after that, we'll have you walk through the fiscal notes for the Department of Law. So with that, Mr. Skidmore.
Very well. This is John Skidmore. Are you able to hear me all right?
Yes, we can.
Fantastic. Again, John Skidmore, the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division for the State of Alaska Department of Law. You all have in front of you HB 66 and a brief recap. This is a bill that is part of the puzzle for the administration in combating the increase in drug delivery that we've seen in the state and overdose deaths. It does this by increasing penalties related to delivery or distribution of controlled substances in four ways. First, it addresses when controlled substance delivery results in an overdose death, and that is by moving a subsection of manslaughter to murder two, which effectively raises the penalties for that conduct. The second way it does it is that it increases the classification or delivery of drugs when the person receiving them is incapable, incapacitated, or unaware. The delivery of those drugs would have already been illegal. This just increases the classification when the victim is in one of those three conditions. The third way that it approaches it is that it adds the delivery of Schedule 1A to conduct that is referred in the criminal law as a special circumstance for Class A felonies. That effectively increases the presumptive sentencing range for a first offense from 4 to 7 years to 7 to 11 years. Again, that's for Schedule 1 drugs for things such as fentanyl. The fourth way that it increases penalties in this bill is then it addresses something called good time. And we talked about this at the last hearing. Good time is the way in which individuals who are sentenced and have good behavior can be released on parole earlier. If they do not behave, then their good time is taken away from them. What this bill does is it would add the delivery of controlled substances to the list of crimes for which good time is not a possibility. That's for things such as murder and other Class A or unclassified felonies in 1141 or crimes against persons. So those are the four ways in which the bill seeks to increase sentences. Again, this is only one part of the administration's approach to combating the problems with drugs in the state. There are other bills out there that address to seek the addiction and providing more resources for people to deal with those issues. The last thing that I would note about the bill is that it is not criminalizing any conduct that is not already illegal. That is, everything the bill does addresses conduct that is already illegal. It is just adjusting sentences so that the delivery of the drugs, not the possession or the use of them, but the delivery of the drugs, receives higher penalties. That's the short summary that or recap that I would give of the bill for you. And with that, unless there was any questions, I'll move to the fiscal note.
Great. Thank you very much. We've got questions. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Mr. Skidmore, when you were going through your four topics, and you mentioned good time last, you mentioned the most sort of heinous conduct involving delivery, but there's far more benign conduct that would also not receive good time under the bill. True?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, yes. To be clear, the good time restrictions apply to any delivery of a controlled substance. The delivery that results in death is not affected by this provision of good time, because in those circumstances, that would already be a manslaughter or a murder, and good time is restricted for murder crimes already. So the good time doesn't have any impact on that. Your question is, does this affect all other deliveries? And the answer to that is yes, it does.
Further questions for Mr. Skidmore? Seeing none, Mr. Skidmore, if you can walk us through the Department of Law's fiscal note.
Certainly, Chair. This is OMB component number 2202. It is control number lowercase w, y, uppercase e, u, j. And this was published on April 7th of 2023. The Department of Law's fiscal note is a zero. The reason for this is that though we believe there is the possibility of some increased litigation because of increased penalties, that increased litigation is not significant enough to warrant any additional positions or spending from us. And I would refer back to the last comment I gave you all about the bill, and that is this bill does not criminalize any conduct that was not previously already a crime. And so it's not as though there are more cases coming to the Department of Law. It just means that the consequences or the penalties for some of that conduct might be increased. And for that reason, we have a zero fiscal note.
Great. Thank you. Questions on Department of Law's fiscal notes? Seeing no questions, anything in wrap-up, Mr. Skidmore?
No, I think you all heard the last hearing, the administration's position on the bill. There are certainly some of these provisions that we recognize are more widespread impacts. I believe Representative Josephson discussed one of them just a few moments ago. We're very interested in that conversation with you all in terms of what's the right policy calls to be made here. But otherwise, I will be available for questions this afternoon, and I'll leave it to the other people that I know you have lined up to touch on.
Great. Thank you very much. So we'll move on to the other departments. Next up, we have the Department of Corrections. Deputy Commissioner April Wilkerson is in the room here. If you can come up to the table and put yourself on the record, and if you have any comments on the good time deductions or any other comments that you have, we'll go to questions and then the fiscal note. So if you have any opening comments.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is April Wilkerson, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections. The comment that I would make is primarily the good time within the legislation is the biggest impact to the department's offender population. We do have Chief Time Accounting Officer for the department, Sydney Wood, online for any detailed questions regarding good time impacts and calculations.
Ms. Wood, are you online? And if so, just want to see if you have any comments on the good time portion of this. You can put yourself on the record.
For the record, my name is Sydney Wood. I'm the Deputy Director of Institutions and Chief Time Accounting Officer for the department.
Okay, thank you. Sounds like no comments. Any questions for either of them? Representative Galvin?
Thank you very much, Co-Chair Foster. And I know that we covered this just a bit last time, but I see that there's not been any changes to this, so I just want to reconfirm one more time that while we are currently with this, the way it's written, we are expecting that there will be more people who will be incarcerated for longer periods of time. And we know there's beds for it, and we know there are people in the building, but I think about food costs. I think about other, even laundry and electricity. And I just can't help but wonder if that isn't in some way going to accelerate our costs should this come and become law.
Ms. Wilkerson?
Through the chair to Representative Galvin. You are correct. So currently, based on our current capacity, we have the ability to grow by about another 650 inmates before we're looking at, you know, adding capacity to the department. Our budget is currently sufficient for the current capacity that we do have. Some of the drivers that we see that take us outside of the budget are actually costs. So the increasing economic costs, those are what take us outside of our allocated budget. So we do feel that while this will help, this will meet that crossroads sooner than projected, we don't see the exceeding our capacity within the next 6 to 10 years at this point.
Paul?
I guess I just would ask if it's possible, Sheriff Foster, to have a sense of, we know that other bills have come into play in our state and history, which have resulted in more Alaskans in prison. Sometimes, absolutely, properly so. I'm not suggesting that we don't pass this law. I just want to make sure that we're very careful to not set you up for a situation where your staff is feeling not supported, and also that the state doesn't incur costs. That I think what you're suggesting is that right now it's okay if we add in people, but there would likely be costs. It's just not something you're at this point able to calculate or determine. And I'm wondering if you can look at previous budgets to see when you did get a sudden slope up or something other than, because it's not just the number of people who are working in the prison system, but it's also food. It's also clothing. It's also water and sewer. So that's, to me, important that we are mindful of that, and if we can, make us aware so that we can budget for it in the future.
Ms. Wilkerson, any comment before we move to the next question?
Through the chair to Representative Galvin, your point is taken very clearly, and as we compound those legislations on top of each other, it does have a greater impact than just looking at them individually. Thank you.
Thank you. Got Representative Stapp, Kronk, and Hannon. Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Coach Foster. Through the chair to the folks at Corrections, I'm just curious, how many drug felons get awarded good time in the state on an annual basis?
Through the chair to Representative Stapp, right now we anticipate just under 100 individually would be impacted on a daily basis through this legislation. But those individuals, the actual number, I would defer to see if Chief Time Accounting Officer Wood has that number handy.
Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Wood?
For the record, this is Sid Wood again. Through the chair, that's not a number I have handy. I can tell you that unless there's some other something else impacting the sentence, such as other charges, generally speaking, drug charges do earn good time. So all of the folks that are in custody at this time, unless there's something else impacting it, do earn good time on their sentences.
Yeah, follow up if you could. Thank you, Coach Foster. How many folks are currently in custody in that line of question? We have a ballpark?
Through the chair to Representative Stapp, currently today we have about 4,450 in custody today. I would like to point out that the bulk of our population that is incarcerated for a drug charge are under misconduct in the Fifth. So this legislation is for those individuals convicted of 1 through 4 So the bulk of the individuals would remain receiving good time.
Paul, do you have a number on that bulk?
Through the chair to representative staff, I do, but I don't have it with me in front of me.
And one last follow-up, if you would, Co-Chair Foster. Just my last question is, how many drug convictions are there annually in Alaska?
Through the chair to representative staff, I'll have to get that as well.
Okay. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster.
Thank you. Maybe before we go to the other questions, as they might be fiscal related, maybe it is a quick zero fiscal note. Maybe if I could have you walk us through Department of Corrections fiscal note, which is OMB component 1381.
Thank you. The Department of Corrections fiscal note dated February 8th of 2023 is primarily looking at those individuals within the institutions. Like I pointed out a little bit ago, our current population is running about 83 to 85% capacity, which leaves room of growth of about 650 of our general capacity beds, and then just over 800 of our maximum capacity beds. And that is without the current beds that are offline due to construction. So we do have a little bit of room to grow. We anticipate with this legislation will impact the department's daily population starting in year three, and would be an overall growth of about 97 individuals would be held longer per day.
Thank you. And so back to questions, Representative Kronk and then Hannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair. So to simplify this, you know, some people are worried about how do you have a zero fiscal note or low. You're budgeting for this many people and you don't have quite that many people. And so you can just incur the cost if you know, let's say 40 more people stay there. It's just to simplify that. It's not like you're adding a bunch of more costs. You're already but basically funded for that and you just don't have that capacity yet, to make it simple.
Through the chair to Representative Kronk, that is correct. So due to COVID and some of the other changes that have happened over the last 3 years, it has slowed the growth of the offender population, which does allow us to absorb this population associated with this change.
Representative Hannon and then Josephson.
Thank you, Chair Foster. I'm Ms. Wilkerson, frequently we've talked about cost and cost drivers at the Department of Corrections largely being not the beds, but health conditions, and this is a very sick population. By your own data and testimony at various points, the Department of Corrections has said 80% of the people incarcerated have a substance use disorder. And I am curious as to how many of those people are able to get programming for substance use disorders, whether we know the cost of that, and then if this bill were to pass, we've sort of added in the likelihood that we've got a percentage of people staying in longer who are likely to have had a substance use disorder, and I'm wanting to see whether we're going to be able to accommodate them, because they're going to be with us for a longer time, earlier for it. But certainly my impression has been we already can't provide substance use disorder treatment for the majority of people incarcerated, but hoping you can answer that.
Through the chair to Representative Hannon, I can get those numbers for you. I do know that we currently offer those programming to while they are incarcerated. We use our contractors, and just like with the rest of us, they too are facing the workforce challenges. We are currently looking at technology to try and expand the ability for programming using different technology sources and telehealth type of equipment. But I can get you the wait list numbers and the costs associated with that.
Hello. Thank you, Chair Foster. And Ms. Wilkerson, is it still true in my mind that for many of those programming offers, because they're limited both by budget and contractors' availability, that we've prioritized folks getting those programs as they get closer to release? So in the last 2 years of their 10-year sentence. And so I am curious whether we've been able to expand that. So someone who's coming in who under this bill now has no good time release, so really no sentence motivation to participate earlier, whether we, where that's going to go on the scale of can we get them programming off of their addiction while they're serving a sentence, or they're going to sit there for 10 years and then maybe there's a year of treatment.
Through the chair to Representative Hannon, we do prioritize for those individuals that are closer to release. However, as space is available and as the desire for programming is requested, we will go ahead and meet those needs as well. Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, you said something that's somewhat tangential, but you brought it up and it surprised me. You said that most of your offenders in 1171, that is drug cases, are in the mixed five category. And I look at that and I say, oh, okay, well, the first type of that is marijuana related. I got to believe there's less and less of that than ever before, because there's no point to, in particular, to be criminal about it. Then there's one on record keeping. I don't know if that comes up. And then it says possession of all the other schedules. So I guess that's what it is that most people in custody in the state who are guilty of an 1171 offense weren't convicted of delivering or manufacturing, but rather possessing. Is that? And it may be part of a plea bargain. Maybe that was the easy compromise to reach. I don't know.
Through the chair to Representative Joseph, I don't have that level of detail, but I can get the actual conviction charge citation with those numbers for the committee, if you would like.
And it may be that Mr. Skidmore knows more about that, but it just surprised me that people are in custody for possessing, and I get that. I just didn't think you'd say that.
Mr. Skidmore, just wanted to give you an opportunity to respond if you wanted.
Thank you, Chair. Looking at the 1171 crimes, there's possession with intent to deliver, and I'm not sure if that's what you're ultimately going to find the folks that Ms. Wilkerson is referring to or not. I would actually have to see those statistics as well, but that's one of the things that we often want to be cautious of when we are looking at the conduct, is whether or not you're dealing with just a possession or possession with intent to deliver. The mixed five typically is just possessing one of them and is not the possession with intent to deliver. But that does what you end up with in the mixed four and the mixed three. And in those instances, as Mr. Josephson, Representative Josephson indicated, it's not out of the realm of possibility that many individuals that possess with the intent to deliver then end up resolving their charges with just simply the possession charge. But without more specific details, I can't provide any more information than that.
Thank you.
Representative Cologne.
Thank you, Chair, through the chair. So I wanted to see how the Department of Corrections felt about good time. What I'm understanding is that good time's there to incentivize people to get on track, to increase behavior in the correctional facility, and that it's an incentive to, get out earlier and get on track earlier. Is that your position, that it serves as an incentive for people to get on track?
Through the chair to Representative Cologne, we do look at it that way. However, this is one of several tools that the department uses. The department still has community placement that they can utilize in the future if good time was removed from these individuals.
Follow up. So, okay, so community placement after they get out. Can you expand on what that means?
Through the chair to Representative Cologne, we can better utilize our halfway house beds. We can better utilize electronic monitoring if these individuals were no longer eligible for good time.
Okay. On follow-up.
Oh.
So Can you explain to me kind of what are the active treatment programs in correctional facilities right now? What do they look like?
Through the chair to Representative Coulombe, are you asking for the provider themselves or the process?
So through the chair, I guess what I'm looking for is some clarity. If you have someone that has possession, even with an intent to sell, you know that they have a drug problem. What is happening in the correctional facilities themselves to help them get off drugs?
Through the chair to Representative Coulombe, I'm going to have to get back to you on the details of that. When an offender is booked into the facility and a risk assessment and their scores on that risk assessment will identify what their programmatic needs are while they're incarcerated. And then we offer the various programs to the individual to assist them in reentry supports to assist with their addictions.
Okay, and one more follow-up. So I'm hearing that, so it's kind of something that happens when they get released. There's not, I guess there's 12-step groups. Is there something within the correctional facility themselves that they are getting treatment for their drug abuse problems? And I ask that because this is asking for people to stay there longer. If there's no real treatment within the facility, it's kind of pushing the problem down the line. It's not really helping anything other than keeping them off the street. And in some cases, that might be, you know, valid. But I'm trying to wrap my head around what actual programs are being used in the facilities while they're incarcerated.
Through the chair, to Representative Coulombe, we can get you a detailed list. But we do offer assessments. We offer volunteers come in to provide NA and or AA as needed, and then we also have providers that are providing substance abuse treatment, both residential and short-term outpatient type. But I can get you a detailed list by facility of those programs that are offered.
Thank you.
Okay. Do you have a question, Representative Orchins?
No.
Representative Tomaszewski?
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. I was able to have the opportunity last week to be at Lemon Creek Correctional Facility and spoke with several of the inmates there. They're very aware of the good time parole, even though they're not really aware of this bill. Just talking with them, they are aware of the good time. So I'm looking at the bill, page 4, section 5. So it's one-third of their term for good parole, or for good behavior, apparently. Is there other degrees of good time that they get? Can they get, that's a one-third of their time. Is there a half time for other offenses? Is there, a quarter time for other offenses?
I'm through the chair to Representative Tomaszewski. There is not. So it's just a flat one-third of their time. It's automatic, and then they can lose it. But I would defer to Chief Time Accounting Officer Wood to see if he has any additional information.
Mr. Wood?
This is Sydney Wood from the Department of Corrections, for the record. Through the chair, Deputy Commissioner Wilkerson was correct. It is one-third by statute. There are other limiting factors that can make it less than that, but nothing that makes it more than that.
Okay, thank you. Can I have a follow-up?
Follow-up.
And one other question. In Section 4, page 4, changing of the date 7 to 11 years for the first offense. The second offense in the very next line is 10 to 14 years. The third offense is 15 to 20 years. I was just wondering and curious if the first offense – of 11 years you can actually get more years on the first offense than you could technically get on the second offense. Is that just a mistake, or do you just leave it as for leeway to the judges who actually hand down these sentences?
To the chair, to represent Thomas, I'm going to ask Mr. Skidmore to provide clarification on that.
Mr. Skidmore?
This is John Skidmore for the record. Through the chair to Representative Tomaszewski, the answer to your question is that the 7 to 11 is a presumptive range for a first-time offense. The presumptive range for a second felony would be 10 to 14, which is what you're reading there. So a second-time offense, theoretically, you could say someone would get 10 years, where on the first offense they got 11, but the likelihood of that is very slim, because what will happen in the sentencing is that the courts will consider the previous offenses and the sentences that someone received and the conduct. So it's unlikely that you would end up with a sentence going backwards for a subsequent offense. But the range does technically allow it to be as low as 14 for a second offense, but as low as 10, but as high as 14. And for the first offense, should this bill pass, it would be 7 to 11.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Ms. Wilkerson? Seeing none, thank you very much. Next up, we'll have the courts, and we've got Ms. Nancy Mead here. Ms. Mead, if you can come up and give us any comments that you might have, and then walk us through the fiscal notes, and then we'll take questions. And just for folks, the fiscal note is judiciary, and that should be OMB component 768. Ms. Mead, if you can put yourself on the record.
This is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. The court has no position on the bill. The decisions about classifications of offenses and penalties are for your branch of government. We have a zero fiscal note. Sometimes when penalties increase, it might lead to more trials instead of plea bargains. We do not anticipate much of an impact from this. The provision that moves the manslaughter to second-degree murder is very rarely used, has been very rarely used over the years, and so I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions of the committee? Seeing none, looks like we're off and away. Thank you. So next up, we will go to the Public Defender's Office. Online, we have Public Defender Samantha Chereau. Ms. Chereau, if you're there, if you can put yourself on the record and provide us any comments you might have on the bill. And then also, let's see, it looks like you don't have any fiscal notes. So, if you could just give us any thoughts that you might have on the bill.
To Chair Foster, thank you. Samantha Chereau, Public Defender for the Public Defender Agency. Thank you to the committee. We do have a fiscal note, and I can turn to that. After my comment, as this committee has heard, and the bill would enhance penalties for certain drug offenses, eliminate good time for felony-level distribution of drugs, and establishes a new murder charge where a person manufactures or delivers controlled substances and a person dies as a result, our agency would see an increase in workload. Cases charged as high-level felonies and with more significant penalties often result in increased litigation and pretrial preparation that can include contested sentencing and post-conviction litigation, increasing the workload and cost for the public defender agency. Such increased litigation at the pretrial level may cause further delays and mean that persons in pretrial status and charged with certain drug offenses will not have access to treatment programs while in custody until and unless convicted and sentenced. Upon release, they will not have access to treatment and reentry services as they would have when released for good time and supervised by a probation officer while on mandatory parole. Most often, the charged individuals that we serve and who would be impacted by this bill need treatment and reentry services to tackle their addiction while in custody and once they're out of custody and returning to their communities. With that, I can turn to the fiscal note if it's the will of the committee.
Yes, if you can go ahead and walk us through the fiscal note, and that it looks like it's OMB component 1631.
Yes, thank you. And the control code is capital D, lowercase f, lowercase n, capital D. Our fiscal note was prepared on February 1st. It primarily consists of personal services costs for two attorney positions. These would be practicing trial attorneys, one in Anchorage and one in our Palmer office, due to the volume of cases in those areas, particularly related to charged drug offenses. And it would continue year to year, those positions.
Great. Thank you. I'm just noting, it just kind of jumped out at me that Department of Law has the zero fiscal note, and yet Public Defenders has a $449,000 fiscal note. So I guess I'm just mentioning that, but don't have any questions on it. Do we have any questions, Representative Stout?
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, could you repeat what you said about reentry services in a good time, if you don't mind?
Sure. Simply pointing out that reentry services would not be available, as individuals would not be on mandatory parole. They would not be supervised by probation officers, and a lot of times those individuals link them to treatment programs and other reentry services.
Follow up.
So through the chair to so basically we're going to take away the good time, and then they're not going to have reentry services and treatment services. Is that what I'm hearing?
To Chair Foster, to represent that, that's correct. Without the, I think, structure and support systems, the individuals could access those services, but they would have to do that on their own.
Thank you.
Further questions of the committee for Ms. Chereau?
But yeah.
Representative Josephson?
I think the chair, Ms. Chereau. So if a person has a sentence of 3 years, we'll call it four, three to serve, and they do get good time under current law, so they get out in 2 years, and during that year they otherwise would have been in custody, DOC offers them all programs like treatment and reentry. Is that? And so if they don't get that third off, they don't get those programs. Is that what you said?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, I think there's two aspects to this. One, in my experience, clients really don't have access to treatment programs in custody until they are sentenced. So where there's enhanced penalties and these cases are less likely to resolve, those individuals are in pretrial status longer. They're not going to have access to those services while they're in custody until they're sentenced, and from what I heard from other testimony, really until the end of their sentence. They then would not be released on mandatory parole because they've lost that good time. And so the supervision and services that comes along with that when they are released, they would not have access to. They would not have that support for reentry services or treatment. They would have to access that on their own. They would not have that probation supervision that they would have had.
Follow up?
They would have some probation. In my hypothetical, for example, where there was a year suspended, they would be on paper, and so they would have some connection to DOC's probation officers. But
through the chair to Representative Josephson, that's correct. Of course, probation being distinct from parole. I do think one consequence of this is that individuals could be less likely to opt for a reduced sentence of active jail time with suspended jail time that would involve probation. They may be more likely to opt for a flat time sentence because they're not going to be monitored on parole. So would they then opt to be monitored on probation? Perhaps not.
A follow-up? Is your reading of this, and I don't think this has come up, but maybe it did, and I don't want the committee to think that discretionary parole is a common thing, but could someone theoretically get, as you read the bill, get discretionary parole, which is a third off, but not get mandatory parole, which is admittedly counterintuitive in some way?
To the chair to Representative Josephson, this would not impact the discretionary parole.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, do we have any further questions of Ms. Chereau? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much for your presentation. And so next we will move over to OPA, Office of Public Advocacy. We've got online Director James Stinson. Mr. Stinson, if you're there, if you can put yourself on the record, and if you've got any thoughts on the bill, and then walk us through the fiscal notes.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Foster. For the record, James Stinson, Director of the Office of Public Advocacy. I think Ms. Chereau pretty much covered the defense perspective and the issues therein. My fiscal note, OMB component number, is 43. The control code is capital R, capital W, lowercase s, lowercase s, lowercase d. And I'm requesting one attorney for in Anchorage for similar reasons. I believe that this would be sufficient for the agency to be able to meet the impact of this new legislation.
Great. Thank you very much. Do we have any questions for Mr. Stinson? And if folks have any questions that they think of after we go through the lineup here, I'm happy to go back to folks while we've got them online today. Representative Co-Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question through the chair. All right, I do have a question, and I suddenly kind of have forgotten it, but it has to do with the, just in general, how long does it take to hire? You have the one position, well, one is in the one OPA attorney position. How long does it normally take, will it take to get that person hired and then on board?
So through the chair, Representative Johnson, I guess the answer is it depends. We've actually been fairly lucky in the latest hiring cycle with finding folks. Sometimes that can be seasonal. It depends on if you're hiring, you know, graduating law clerks and law students, which is coming up relatively soon here as we hit the summer months. You know, sometimes you can hire a newer attorney two into an existing position and then advance somebody to an attorney four slot. Sometimes you can have an internal promotion. It just really depends.
Follow up. So, would you have the range difference between an attorney one and an attorney four position? I see $181,000 in here for both the positions in OPA as well as the trial attorneys. I was just seeing if that looks to be just a standard number. I was trying to figure out what the other numbers might be.
Representative, through the chair, I think I understand your question now. So we typically staff these as flex PCNs, and it's based on attorney two through four. So it's an average range set is typically how we staff these. So all of the PCNs that are not attorney fives at OPA are flexibly staffed. We only have one attorney one position. That's not where people start out, and that's essentially a bail attorney position where somebody doesn't even need to have passed the bar exam yet. So we really do have mostly attorneys two through four, and they're almost all flexibly staffed.
And then follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if you mostly hire positions, attorney two through four, what you know offhand what the attorney two standard amount is, I mean, including their benefits and so on. So this one was attorney four with benefits and so on is $181,000. Do you know what that comparable amount is for, like, an attorney two?
Johnson, I may not be able to answer that offhand. I could certainly guesstimate, but I wouldn't want to give you a number that's not accurate.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Chair Foster. I'm in looking at this bill, I'm also looking at the entire packet, inclusive of a letter. Clearly, this is a problem, and I'm also looking at the different pieces in here that help us to understand the evidence-based strategies to reduce drug overdose deaths. In this particular piece is brought to us from the Alaska Department of Health. It goes over various strategies. None of them include what we're talking about today, and I appreciate that we did hear that there were other things that were going to happen that would be part of reducing deaths, and I think we're going to just say the word fentanyl because that was, I think, part of the governor's initial wish was to reduce those particular deaths. That said, we're still now looking at this one methodology of getting at our problem of drugs that are circulating, and I think we're talking about whether or not a longer sentence is going to be the fix, and I'm wondering if anyone who's online can speak to any evidence around this deterrence working in Alaska, first of all, and number two is when what I've read from the Department of Justice U.S. is that deterrence works. There's four different ways, and one of the main thing is that those who would be affected by this need to know about it. And I'm not sure that there's a sense that if this good time it goes away, first of all, like I said, are we going to see then less of this behavior? And secondly, how are Alaskans going to know that there is no more good time for these particular offenses so that potentially deterrence could work?
Mr. Stinson, I'll give you first crack at that. And if anybody else has any comments, Mr. Stinson.
So, Chair Foster, in terms of overarching policy decisions, I don't envy any of your jobs. You're all wearing heavy crowns in terms of that. You know, my main concern is ensuring that the agency is adequately resourced so that when this legislation passes, we're able to absorb the impact of that and serve the clients as best we can. I'm not overly comfortable expounding any further than that. I know that what you all do is difficult, and I guess I'll leave it at that if that's all right.
Thank you. Ms. Schroe, do you have any comments?
Thank you, Chair Foster. To Representative Galman, I would just comment that I'm not aware of any evidence-based research demonstrating that increased sentences will increase deterrence.
Representative Galvin, would you like to direct that question to anyone else? No? Okay. Do we have any further questions for Mr. Stinson? Seeing no questions, thank you very much, Mr. Stinson. We'll next move over to the Department of Public Safety. That's Lisa Purinton. If you can put yourself on the record, and if you have any comments on the bill itself, otherwise you can jump right into the fiscal notes.
Thank you, Co-Chair. For the record, Lisa Purinton, Acting Legislative Liaison with the Department of Public Safety. Don't have a comment at this time, so I'll just go into the fiscal note. We also have a zero fiscal note for this bill. OMB component is 2744. The control number is all capitalized. It's B as in Bravo, O-F-I-M as in Mike, and it was on a published date of February 28th, 2023.
Thank you. Any questions of the fiscal note? See no questions, so thank you very much. Okay, next we've got Department of Family and Community Services. Online we have Mr. David Flatten. If you can put yourself on the record, and if you have any comments on the bill, otherwise please explain the fiscal note.
Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, David Flatten.
Mr. Flatten, it's hard to hear you, and we've turned up the volume on our end. Is it possible to get closer to the mic?
I'll try again. Good afternoon. This is David Flatten, Social Services Program Officer with the Division of Juvenile Justice. We also have a zero fiscal note.
Great. Thank you. Please go ahead and walk us through that.
Yes, the OMB component number is 2134, and the control code is lowercase h, lowercase o, capital A, lowercase o, capital N, and that was published on February 8th, 2023.
Mr. Flatten, if you could walk us through, it looks like a zero fiscal note, if you can just walk us through that.
Correct. reflected in the zero fiscal note. The crime that is reclassified by the proposed legislation is exceptionally rare as far as referrals to the Division of Juvenile Justice. We don't anticipate any fiscal impact on the division.
Great. Thank you. Representative Hannon?
Thank you, Chair Foster. And I have, his name has escaped me, but my question has to do with when Mr. Skidmore first described the bill and described it was very rare. There's been five or six, maybe seven cases that could have fallen under this or are similarly prosecuted in the last decade. I'm wondering if any of those have been juveniles and whether you have encountered many juvenile cases where the crime involved two juveniles having shared the one delivering the drug to another. Do those drug cases arrive very much in the juvenile system?
Thank you. For the record, David Slotin, through the chair to Representative Hannon. No, those are exceptionally rare as well. The vast majority of the drug-related crimes we receive are in regards to cannabis use.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any further questions of Mr. Flatton? Seeing none, thank you very much for presenting that. We'll next move over to, it looks like I think that is all of the fiscal notes. Are there any that I've forgotten? I don't think so. So I think that takes care of all the fiscal notes. Would like to move over to public testimony. We do have a few people, I think maybe five or six. So I'll go ahead and open public testimony on House Bill 66. That's controlled substances, homicide, and good time deductions. Just as a reminder, written testimony can be submitted to the committee at house.finance@akleg.gov. So with that, is there anyone in the room who would like to testify? Seeing none, we'll go to the lines here. First up, we've got Stacy Isert, I believe, calling from Anchorage. If you can state your name and your affiliation, proceed with your testimony.
Yes, hello. My name is Stacy Isert. I thank you for the opportunity to give my testimony today in support of House Bill 66. I am testifying for myself and my deceased son. March 10th, 2021 was the worst day of my life and the beginning of the nightmare, which has become my everyday reality. That day 2 years ago, our son Jason died from chemical homicide from fentanyl poisoning at the age of 41. Jason had a master's degree in English literature and worked as an Anchorage High School English teacher. He loved music and was an awesome drummer and saxophone player. Jason always had a warm hug for anyone who may need it and would literally give the shirt off his back to help someone in need. Jason lost three very good friends to death and struggled emotionally with death. Jason married in 2016 and had two sons who were the apple of his eye. When Jason's marriage fell apart, he began to self-medicate. After losing everything in the divorce, he was devastated and made some unhealthy decisions. Then on March 10th, 2021, unbeknownst to him, he ingested some lethal drugs which contained a deadly dose of fentanyl. Jason's roommate stepped out for half an hour to pick up groceries. And when he returned, he found Jason collapsed in the bathroom. He called 911 and performed CPR, but it was too late. Jason was gone. What followed was the police coming to our door telling us the fateful news of Jason's passing. No parent should ever have to endure the immense pain that we experienced that night and continue to endure every day. We lost a son. And his children will never know their daddy. Jason's brother lost a sibling, and his sons lost an uncle, not to mention the family members, friends, colleagues, and students who lost this wonderful man. Jason was adamant about being an organ donor, but due to the lethal way he died, they were unable to use his organs to save someone else's life. My family's lives are forever changed and will never be the same. So yes, I support House Bill number 66. My son's death was an act of homicide by those persons who knowingly manufactured or delivered a controlled substance to Jason, which led to his death. There isn't a prison sentence for these individuals that can compare to the prison sentence my husband and I endure every day, the prison sentence of grief and heartache. Some days are so painful that I don't feel I can go on. The grief, pain, and heartache will never cease in my prison sentence, and they will be my prison sentence until the day I take my last breath. Unfortunately, our story is just one of thousands. How many more lives will be lost and families ruined to this disregard for human lives and blatant act of homicide? There must be consequences for their actions, so more lives will not be lost and families destroyed. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Ms. Isert, for calling in and for your testimony. Do we have any questions or comments from the committee? I don't see any, so again, thank you for calling in. Next up, we have Nicole Cleary calling in from Eagle River. Ms. Cleary, if you can state your name and your affiliation.
Yes, thank you for having me today. Thank you for all you guys do. My name is Nicole Cleary. Excuse me. My son was Gage McKinsey. He died October 7th, 2021 from acute fentanyl poisoning. He had three different types of fentanyl in the system. The first type was a non-lethal dose of pharmaceutical fentanyl, and then two lethal doses of two different other types of fentanyl with no other drugs in his system or alcohol. Gage had a really normal childhood, but he ended up starting smoking weed with his friends, and then eventually it went to the harder drugs. He was in and out of jail for years, until the last 2 years before his death. He got out, he did a program in the jail where they put him into an inpatient treatment, and then after he completed his 90 days, he was released, where he completed another outpatient treatment for an additional 90 days. He graduated from that. He went to sober living and got a job, paying child support, taking care of everything, doing everything like he normally did when he was sober, you know, living a normal life. We thought we were on the upswing. And then that morning, I got the phone call that he had passed away with no real clue or indication that he had been using again or anything like that. And unbeknownst to him, his friend gave him lethal doses of fentanyl and murdered him. And to say this hasn't impacted my life is an understatement. My entire family is ripped apart over this. And his brother is devastated. His friends are devastated. He left two beautiful little boys who will never see their dad again. And I have to tell them when they see his pictures that he's no longer here. I support this bill 100% because maybe it'll help with another parent so they don't have to go through what I go through on a daily basis. Because it's not something that you ever want to see. You never want to show up to see your son being carried out in a body bag. And I hope that with the stronger sentence that maybe it'll stop and detour people from selling fentanyl to other people.
I do apologize. I'm so emotional, but this has been extremely traumatic on me because he's my firstborn child. It's devastating for all the other mothers and families in Alaska and throughout the world that this is happening to. I do thank you for letting me talk today. And again, I do apologize for being so emotional. But I do hope that everybody takes an account and passes this bill for us in Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Cleary. We appreciate your calling in.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any questions or comments from the committee? I don't see any. So, again, appreciate your calling in, Ms. Cleary. Next up, we have Karen Malcolm-Smith calling from Arizona. Ms. Malcolm-Smith, if you can state your name and your affiliation.
Yes, my name is Karen Malcolm-Smith, and I'm the president and founder of the David Dillon Foundation. I'm also a member of the Alaska Mental Health Board, but my testimony today is strictly personal and does not reflect the opinions or the recommendation of the board in which I serve. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. Today, May 1st, is my son's birthday. He was my only child and has been 31 years old today. Last night I set out a pile of pictures and memorabilia. And as usual, when I get up in the morning, I try to shift my thinking to find some kind of joy in the day. To the right of this pile this morning was also an inch and a half stack of 2022 DEA and Border Patrol interdictions. And in it, the information that included 51 million fentanyl-laced fake pills that were interdicted this last year and 13,000 pounds of pure powder, enough to kill the entire U.S. and more. It is a national and state nightmare. My son Dylan's struggle began at age 14 following a near-fatal ATV accident and months of prescription opioids, but nonetheless, he returned to his passions for music and martial arts and did okay in school, was well-known for his comic wit, and he would never, ever bypass an opportunity to help the underdog, to come to the aid of an animal, or anyone at all, including all of you that were in trouble, even if it meant the old-fashioned way. He was could have been a Golden Glove boxer. In college in Arizona, Dylan was reintroduced to pills at parties, and when the ever-so strategic cartel suddenly supplied nothing but black tar heroin, and the pills disappeared, Dylan turned to black tar heroin, and so began a parent's hell. On June 5th, 2017, Dylan was found dead in his bedroom from a polysubstance poisoning. He had just returned from out-of-state treatment. My two-year personal investigation revealed the following. Dylan attended a music festival right out of 2 weeks after treatment, sober, where he met a woman. Later that week, she texted asking if he had a spare room for her for the night. And by the way, Dylan had no felonies and secretly despised drug dealers. Little did Dylan know that this woman was wanted by the FBI and was part of a known family heroin ring with three other known thefts associated with her. The woman's MO is to target kind, compassionate victims, turn their homes into a trap house for a few days, and then move on before her trail got hot. 3 days after moving in, she texted, "You can't kick me out. I have squatter's rights." That weekend, Dylan was comatose, with no less than a dozen cars coming and going at any given time, because it was so out of character for, you know, him as a very likable and respected neighbor, no one called the police. At 4 a.m. on Monday morning, Dylan and his friend physically kicked this woman out of his home after her band of armed friends were gone and barricaded the doors. The friend left at noon. Dylan was found dead alone in his room. We don't know what happened to him. All evidence, including her accounts receivable list, which included the drug, name of the drug, the amount owed, and by whom, was lost when the unseasoned patrol officers that homicide sent. 2 years later, the woman was arrested for lesser charges And there were no consequences or justice for the fatal weekend that ended my son's life and changed my life forever. The mantra of my foundation is, every saint has a past, every sinner has a future. That was a tattoo on my son's arm. And it was also a quote by St. Augustine in 370 AD. As a Christian woman, of course, forgiveness is central to my values. But let me ask you guys this. How would we prosecute someone who opens fire at a school? I mean, manslaughter and good time? The Bible states, let your yes mean yes and your no mean no. No. You have been entrusted as judges for justice. Let's raise the bottom and incentivize for those with a conscience to get clean before your grandchild dies. I implore you to vote yes on HB 66 and say no to the people who are taking out a generation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Malcolm-Smith. Do we have any questions from the committee? Any comments? Seeing none, thank you for calling in. Next, we will go over to Dar Walden, calling in from Anchorage. Dar, if you can put yourself on the record, state your name and your affiliation.
Yes, my name is Dar Walden, and I'm the founder of the Christopher Walden House of Hope nonprofit, and I am the mother of Christopher Walden. My son, Christopher, died September of 2019. Of an overdose of heroin that was laced with 3.5 times the lethal dose of another substance. My son had been clean and drug-free for about 5 years, and we'll never know what sent him back to relapse. Unfortunately, this has affected our family, not only our family, but my real estate team. He was my top producer in my company. He was an amazing young man that was compassionate, that was caring, the one that always stopped and gave his leftover food to the homeless on the street. He spent many years struggling on and off with addiction, and he is one of the children that is caught in the Oxycontin war that has gone on with the Purdue Pharma. He started at about the age of 14 or 15 with gateway drugs, the marijuana, and so on. And then they all, many of the kids, he would be 37 today, many of the kids his age have died. There's been enormous numbers of his class that have all passed away due to oxycodone. When oxycodone gets too expensive, they go to the heroin. And then the heroin right now is deadly, laced with fentanyl. I believe the statistics are 6 out of 10 pills coming off the street right now are laced with fentanyl. That means if your child goes out and uses, they have a 60% chance of dying. The sad part about it is we know who sold him the drug, and we can't do a darn thing about it. The sad part about it is if we don't start creating stronger consequences, the kid that sold my son the drug is now selling your children the drug. We need to stop our kids from dying. And the only way to do it is to increase the consequences, which is why I support this bill. Let's face it, this bill is not for me or Karen, or any of the other mothers who have testified, because our kids are dead. This is for you and your family and your kids' kids. If we don't get this stopped, Alaska is facing one of the biggest disasters of all time. That is why we created the Christopher Walden House of Hope. And we've created that. We've added another 36 beds to the state of Alaska for those kids that have the ability to fight this and win this addiction. So please consider this bill. And thank you for your time and efforts you all put into this.
Thank you very much, Ms. Walden, for your testimony. Do we have any questions from the committee? Any comments? Seeing none, again, thank you for calling in. Next up, we have Bobby Dortson calling in from Fairbanks. Bobby, if you can state your name, your affiliation.
Yes, my name is Bobby Dortson. I'm with the Fairbanks Reentry Coalition. I am calling, first off, I'm grieving with the mothers that just shared their story. And it's impactful knowing the impact that I've caused in my prior lifestyle of selling these drugs myself and being in prison for the sentence that I did. I've did 8 years in prison for these crimes, and while I was in prison, I was able to get education on substance abuse, and since my release, I've gotten my GED and became a substance abuse counselor. But today, I'm more or less developing programs on how to help these substance abuse programs. Can you all hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, so I'm in the phase of developing programs for behavioral health. And I would be in prison right now if I didn't get this good time. I'd be being released in December of 2029. And because of the good time, I was able to get out early on ankle monitor. I wore an ankle monitor for 3 years and was a substance abuse counselor with an ankle monitor on, and was the chairman of the Fairbanks Reentry Coalition as well. So I believe people can change. I believe that if you give them incentives to change, I believe that people like myself are goal orientated, where today I am a part of the opioid task force, and I believe that the senseless deaths of people dying from fentanyl poisoning is rampant, and yes, it is a problem, but I don't think the approach of the HB 66, the second session, should be in there. I think that we should remove section two, because I wouldn't be here today if this goes through and the second section, section two was in to remove good time for people with certain felony possessions convictions. I think that I would be still warehoused away in some prison, maybe Goose Creek, not doing anything with my life. And today, a lot of people on this call knows that I'm an advocate. I also am part of a lot of different, but I really know that it was because of you guys believing that people can change and give me the everyday opportunity that I have to work my differences out and show people that people can change and do good for the community. I think that it's very, very valuable to have those incentives of good time, even for the person like myself that made those mistakes. And I love all those mothers on this call. I want them to know that. I love you all. I know you all. I've seen you all and hugged you all. And my love is still there, so I just want you guys to know that. That's all I have today.
Thank you, Mr. Dortson. Do we have any questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you very much for calling in. Our last testifier is Carl, and your last name looks like it's K-A-N-C-I-R, calling from Anchorage. If you can state your name, your affiliation, and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, my name is Carl Canster. Thank you. And first of all, I'm trying to maintain some composure. My heart goes out to the ladies who have lost their loved ones and their families. They have my deepest sympathy. But we have a lot of problems here in Anchorage, and I'm sure you're aware of this, with a lot of the so-called homeless people. And I call them so-called homeless people because a lot of them are just too lazy to work. But my thoughts are, to break their addiction, why doesn't the state have a say in this, along with the municipality, build a facility out on Fire Island? Now, the reason for that is I feel that you have to separate the drug users, alcohol users, and abusers from the suppliers, from the pushers and the dealers. And perhaps that would work, and people could get clean that way. And let those people, when they go out there, if you build a facility out of Fire Island, make them do their own cooking, get some people out there that can wash their own dishes, clean their own, do their own laundry, and things like that instead of the state or municipality paying for it. Now, getting to the drug pushers and abusers, my thoughts are, why not have an Alaskan Alcatraz where you have a prison out on the Aleutian chain on one of the islands, and the first time that a drug pusher or dealer is caught, they go out there for 1 year. The second time they're caught, they go out there for 3 years. The third time they're caught, they go out there for life. I think if they know that that's going to happen, they might decide to get into a different occupation, one that's legal. Now, that sounds cruel, but I have grandchildren and great-grandchildren here in Anchorage, plus some other different parts of the states, that I don't want to see their life wasted because someone wants to push drugs. For my part, if I'm out and I do a lot of walking and I ride the people mover bus, when I'm out, if people offer me a piece of candy, I refuse. If they offer me a stick of chewing gum, I refuse because I don't know what's in it. But you take kids, sure, they want a piece of candy or they want a stick of chewing gum. They don't know the difference. They're not aware of that. But like I said, this may sound cruel, but I think you really have to get cruel with them because they're killing people just the same as if you took a gun and shot someone. I hope I've explained myself well enough. Make myself available for any questions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your time. Thank you for calling in. I'm looking around. I don't see any questions or comments from the committee. So thank you for your testimony. I don't see anybody else online who wants to testify. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify? Seeing none, I will close public testimony for House Bill 66. And so before I set an amendment deadline and set the bill aside and set an amendment deadline for this Wednesday, does the committee have any questions for anyone who we had online earlier? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and set an amendment deadline for Wednesday, May 3rd at 5 p.m. on this bill. And if you do have any amendments, please email them or bring them by my office and give them to Brody Anderson. So with that, we'll set this bill aside and we'll move to the next bill. So thank you, everyone who is here for House Bill 66. The next bill is House Bill 28. And that is the access to marijuana conviction records. We'll have a brief recap from Representative Wright and his staff, Mr. Reardon Randall. The committee will then hear from the courts and the Department of Public Safety on fiscal notes and any questions the committee might have. So with that, Representative Wright and Mr. Reardon Randall, if you could come to the table and please put yourself on the record and give us a brief recap.
For the record, I'm Representative Stanley Wright of House District 22.
For the record, my name is Pyreton Randall, legislative aide to Representative Stanley Wright of House District 22. House Bill 28 aims to reduce barriers for individuals with low-level marijuana possession charges, and it does so in two parts. The first would be to remove it from any background checks on DPS. The second would be to prevent the court system from adding any information regarding such charges back onto the public website. The court system has removed any that were existing that fell into this category already, and that section of the bill had since been removed.
Great. Thank you. Are there any questions of the committee before we go to the two fiscal notes that we have? See no questions. So with that, let's go first to Nancy Mead with the courts. Ms. Mead, if you could come to the table, put yourself on the record. Put yourself on the record again, and if you have any comments on the bill, otherwise, walk us through the fiscal notes.
Thank you. This is Nancy Mead, General Counsel to the Alaska Court System. The court system already does exactly what this bill calls for in its section 4. That section is not necessary since the court took the action of amending its own rules about what goes on the public version of court view. That rule amendment is effective today, and I just got the message that the cases were removed today that fall into the category. We have a zero fiscal note because this bill doesn't require us to do anything that we haven't already done. And I would be happy to answer any questions about court view. But as the sponsor said, this bill does two completely different things. The only thing that affects us is Section 4. It's done already. And it's the court's position that since the court has done that via its own rule, that this is unnecessary in the bill.
Great, thank you. We've got two questions, Representative Tomaszewski and then Josephson.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. You said, so the court already does this and it's not necessary, and then you stated that they just did it today. So I'm a little curious and confused on that statement.
Through the chair to Representative Tomaszewski, the court passed a rule amendment that it signed about 2 months ago to accomplish exactly what the bill calls for. The court has a rule about what does and does not appear on the public version of court view. It has many categories. So in February, it happened to amend that rule again, which it does, to take more and more cases off the public version of court view. It signed an order in February with an effective date of May 1 to remove all the old marijuana possession cases for people over 21 with no other convictions in the case. And as of today, that's accomplished. Does that help explain what I meant?
Yes, it does. And if I could have a follow-up.
Follow-up?
Yes, thank you. So that does explain it. And so you said the court has the rules and they changed the rules. Is there anything stopping them to change the rules back?
Through the chair to Representative Tomaszewski, and by the way, I believe that the Supreme Court order that accomplished that rule change was included in your materials. It's called, we call it SCO, Supreme Court Order 2001. The court could very theoretically reverse itself. That has never happened. And it is, I could say that there is a 0% chance of that happening, especially since the trend now is to remove cases from court view and never at all to add cases to court view in recognition of some of the public concerns about what does appear on there. This category of cases in particular are cases that, by definition, were resolved prior to legalization in 2015, or at least the offense occurred prior to legalization. And there is, as I say, a 0% chance that the court would sort of want to republicize what happened in those old cases. The court, I think, considered this something of a cleanup. And so I would say no.
Okay, thank you. And just one other quick follow-up. So does the court have any objection to this bill, this law, this bill here?
Through the chair to Representative Tomaszewski, where you can do this via statute. It is our position that since it's completely unnecessary, the court maintains items on court view according to what it thinks is appropriate. It's our own website. It's our case management system. There is a recognition that the public uses it for things other than managing cases. For example, not just the attorneys go on to find out when their next hearing is. People do go on to find out information about people, about their old convictions. The court prefers to make its own rules about what appears on its website under sort of a general separation of powers doctrine. That said, the legislature has previously told the court via statute of a category or two of cases that we need to remove from court view, and we have done so, and there has been no objection. So, no, we're not opposing this bill.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Ms. Mead, I was going to ask you a similar question, but you've answered it pretty comprehensively. I think you've said that there are more than a dozen either infractions or charges or convictions, fill in the blank, that already are not shown in court view. Is that right? That there's already categories of things not shown in court view.
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, that's correct. Our Administrative Rule 40A, this is the 15th subsection. So this is the 15th category of cases that are removed from court view.
Follow up.
If the court system wanted to end court view next week, could it do it?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, yes.
If I'd asked you 5 years ago, do you anticipate all these hearings around the building on court view, what would you have said?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, I don't know what I would have said, but I had not anticipated that court view would become such a topic in this building.
I guess I'm likely to support this bill. I mean, speak to what is obvious, and that is if someone possessed marijuana and had significant criminal charges that for whatever reason were entirely dismissed and not reduced, in other words, the entire case was dismissed, there'd be no way for the public to see that in court view, right? Because charges alone are not sufficient. You would need a conviction to leave the convicted matter on court view. Is that right?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, I'd like to be clear about one distinction. This bill and our rule, which is exactly the same, removes convictions, marijuana possession convictions. We aren't looking at what was originally charged or other charges. You're speaking of cases that are fully dismissed. Cases that are fully dismissed are a category that I alluded to earlier that the legislature has told the court system to remove from court view. So any criminal case, whether it's a murder, whether it's drugs, whether it's an assault, that ends with a full dismissal and or acquittal, come off of court view because of a statute.
Okay, follow up.
Follow up?
Yeah, so I wasn't talking about marijuana convictions. I was talking about second and third and fourth charges. And I think what you're saying is where there's been either an acquittal or a dismissal, those already are gone from court view. So this wouldn't remove more or delete more charges in that respect. Is that right?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, that's correct. A case that ends in full dismissal, full acquittal, not a plea bargain, is already removed from court view under your statute. This removes convictions.
Any further questions? Representative Hammond.
Thank you, Chair Foster. I guess I want to reprise it one more in a different way because sometimes our rabbit will lead to some conclusions. So, Ms. Mead, the court undertook the removal of these convictions once state law changed and those crimes were no longer crimes under state law. So those low-level possessions for people over age 21, those cannabis convictions that as of 2015 were no longer crimes, the court viewed that as a logical extension. Those are no longer crimes. Removing them from court view is now compliant with what today's law. So instead of pulling up and seeing that you have a drug conviction for something that's no longer considered a crime doesn't appear on the record. It wasn't that the court just arbitrarily decides to look at categories of crimes and remove them from court view.
Through the chair to Representative Hannon, I appreciate that. Yes, the court recognized that this was legal conduct, and along with the passage of time, that the value of having it on court view was no longer as strong as the possible consequences of having the case on court view. Perhaps in 2016 or 2017, that wasn't as true because the conduct was more recent. But by 2023, 8 years after legalization, it was the Supreme Court's conclusion that having those cases on court view no longer was a strong enough public benefit in comparison to the possible consequences. And just to clarify, the other categories of things that do not appear on court view, the statute says dismissed cases, but are cases where the value of having the public know about them is generally outweighed by sort of the detriment to the person whose name is up there. One of our biggest categories is domestic violence protective orders that somebody files. They would go on court view. But if the court denies everything, no, I'm not going to give you a short-term order, no long-term order, and there was basically no probable cause even found, those come off because you may be able to imagine the consequences when the court found just nothing. So most of the other categories, or all the categories, are ones where it could be harmful to a person, and really they don't having their name up there is not beneficial.
Okay, Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, I think I'll ask Ms. Mead something about my prior practice of law and see if I'm right about something. So there are about, I think, 2,500 attorneys in Alaska, and my last practice, which was 9 years, was family law and related things like restraining orders, and I was in court constantly doing them. And people would pay us a good deal of money to represent them zealously. And one of the things I did was I needed to know everything about the opposing party, nearly everything. I didn't hire private investigators, but I needed the beauty of court view was it was all this easily accessible, free information. So I didn't have to depose someone. I could simply go down to the courthouse and pull 10, 20 files. Given all these reforms, not just this bill, but previous reforms, if someone is going to try to zealously represent a client, it's going to get more and more challenging to know that you've got the body of evidence in the state of Alaska on an opposing party. Is that fair? I mean, just as an attorney practice matter, and I would note there are 2,500 of us, so this isn't just me. I'm thinking about, you know, a segment of society that does this kind of work. Am I right that you might want to go, an attorney might want to go to the troopers and say, do you have more? Or get a court order or something.
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, this rule, or under our Supreme Court order that said to remove these cases, it takes them off the public version of court view. You could say that an attorney could go back to what existed before there was court view at all and walk into a courthouse. But let me also say that these cases, these 15 categories under our administrative rule, are what we call unpublished. They're not on the public version of court view, but they are not made confidential. You can walk into a courthouse, and we have public kiosks that include all of court view except for truly confidential cases. In other words, it includes those unpublished decisions. If you care a lot, you can walk into a courthouse, use the kiosk, and find out more about individuals than you can find out from your living room.
Great. Thank you.
Any further questions for Ms. Mead? I see none. Thank you very much. And we will now go to the second and last fiscal note, which is Department of Public Safety's Ms. Lisa Purrington. If you can come back to the table, put yourself on the record. If you have any comments on the bill itself, otherwise you can jump right into the fiscal note.
Thank you, Chair. For the record, Lisa Purrington, Criminal Records and Identification Bureau Chief for the Department of Public Safety. We
don't really have a lot to say on the bill, so I'll just jump in right into the fiscal note, if that's okay with the chair. Okay, Department of Public Safety's fiscal note is OMB component 3200. It has a prepared date of April 20th, 2023, and the control number is lowercase 0, uppercase S, uppercase Q, uppercase C, and lowercase M. The department does have a fiscal cost from this bill. However, with the amendments that were made in the committee substitute and the House Judiciary to add a fee to up to $150 for individuals that would request to have these records limited from dissemination in certain background checks under Alaska Statute 1262-160B8. The department revised the fiscal note to now reflect those costs of ideally being borne through the program receipts that would be generated by the fees charged. Because it's unknown how many individuals would actually come forward to request that these records be restricted from dissemination as outlined in the bill, the department has only projected out for a two-year cost. The first-year cost would be $189,100. That would include programming cost of $56,000. The state's criminal history repository, which is different than the records management system that Ms. Mead referenced in Courtview, the Department of Public Safety maintains the state's central repository of criminal history records, so it is a completely separate database. And so with that database being on a mainframe system, we would actually have to contract out those costs to have the programming put in place on the system so that these records would not be disseminated when we request for background checks under Alaska Statute 1262-160B8. The additional cost in year one would be for temporary funding for one full-time position for a criminal justice technician to actually research these records. As been noted in prior hearings, the limitations on this bill is up to 1 ounce of marijuana for individuals that were over age 21 at the time the offense was committed. And unfortunately, with the state's criminal history repository, the statutes for conviction don't always list the age of the individual, so we'd have to make sure we research that to make sure that the age of offense was within the scope of this, and then also making sure that we research the dispositions that did not always have the underlying subsections that would clearly identify that the conviction was for under an ounce of marijuana. So there would be some research involved with the individual request. Some of them would be very easy. Fairly recent convictions would be fairly easy to do, but older convictions would take a little bit of time to do that. And so that's your year one cost, and then year two cost, again, are going to be the cost of the full-time position of a $114,700 to fund that position for the year two cost. And we anticipate both of the year one and year two costs being offset and being funded through the program receipts that would be generated by those individuals paying that $150 fee for those requests.
Thank you very much. Do you have any questions on the fiscal notes? Representative Stapp and Representative Tomaszewski.
Yeah, thank you, Coach Foster, through the chair. So I'm just curious, because of this amendment, the fee structure up to $150 per request, does that change the structure at which the department removes these convictions, effectively not doing that until individuals request doing that, and thereby projecting out the amount of time we'd have to pay for this service to effectively in perpetuity as opposed to just removing them all at one time?
Ms. Parenton?
Through the chair to Representative Stapp, if I understand the question correctly, with the change in the fee structure, yes, we would be getting a fee, but the programming is going to have to be done regardless to make sure that we can prevent these records from being disseminated as requested and outlined in this bill. So those programming costs the department will have to pay right up front. The individuals for hiring the full-time position, we're still going to have to move forward with that if we see that there's more than one or two requests coming in to get this, to have these records disseminated, and unfortunately we will have to research those. As I mentioned, some of them will be fairly easy that we can do in a very short amount of time, but some of them will take that research.
Yeah, follow up.
Thank you, Coach Foster. So just to be clear, I understand that you have the software identification costs. Those are fixed costs. They're not going to change. But in theory, once those are identified, you should be able to remove all of those convictions that meet those criteria in a certain amount of time and then effectively sunset this position that you wouldn't ever need again. But in the event that you keep a fee-for-service model, basically, you're going to have this person on payroll for the state in perpetuity, right? Because you have no idea how far out, how many years out in advance people are going to make these voluntary requests. Is that a fair assessment?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp. Yes, but we anticipate when this law, if this bill were to pass and go into law, we anticipate the bulk of the requests to come in year one and year two, as people are familiar with the law that's passing. But I agree, after year two, three, four, five, then that's kind of an unknown for us, and that's where we weren't comfortable moving forward on that projection.
Yeah, last fall. Thank you, Coach Chair Foster. So, yeah, my only concern here is, in my mind, this position should be basically long-term, non-perm. It should take a couple of years to do all this work, and then that position should sunset. I think what I'm hearing is we're going to have this full-time person added, and they're going to be on there on the payroll from now until, you know, I guess the greatest thing to eternal life we'll see here on Earth is a government bureaucracy, right? So, I don't know. Is this position... currently, as this bill is amended, going to go on in perpetuity or not?
Through the chair to represent staff, ideally we would have that person, if their full-time wasn't addressing individuals' concerns, then the time not spent addressing the individual's concerns could be spent researching those records. And I agree with you that programmatically we could look at the statutes that we do have that clearly identify the under an ounce of marijuana conviction, per person convicted for under an ounce of marijuana when they were over 21 at the time the offense was committed. That could be something we could be done programmatically. Unfortunately, some of the convictions that we have in the system only have a four-digit offense code that says it's a marijuana conviction, and so they will need to be researched. So it's not something we can universally clear out the database for all of the convictions that could possibly qualify under this bill.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Tomaszewski.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. I think there's some confusion on this fee. Page 3 of the bill, lines 5 and 6, it clearly states it pays a fee established by the agency in regulation in an amount that is not less than $150. So apparently $150 is the bottom of the price range, and apparently there is no top range in that price range. Is that accurate?
Through the chair to Representative Tomaszewski, yes, that would be the correct how we would interpret that as well. We set the fiscal note at the baseline of the $150.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions, Representative Josephson and then Cologne?
Through the chair, is your reading of this that you have fiscal receipt authority or that the funds go to the general fund?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, we believe we have the receipt authority for this by the existing legislative authority that we have to take the program receipts for the background checks in general, and we would see that under the same scope unless advised otherwise, but that's how we were interpreting it, so that we saw that we had the program receipt.
Thank you.
Representative Flom.
Thank you, Co-Chair, through the chair. So just I had two things I want to clarify. One is $150 charge per conviction to be removed or per person? Can I get three, if there's two or more than one conviction? Am I getting charged for each conviction or just one charge per person?
Through the chair to Representative Colomb, we were looking at this as a per conviction, because the numbers to kind of add up as we're looking at the convictions, because some there are some individuals that will have
multiple convictions that fall within the scope of this bill.
Okay, so through the chair, can I follow? Okay, so just to be clear, if I had three convictions I wanted wiped out, that would be $450 for the minimum $450 to be able to do that.
Through the chair to Representative Cologne, that's how we were looking at this. But in effect, when we'd go to roll this out, we would look at the numbers and see how many individuals actually fall within that scope, and then we could determine whether we would actually do it as a per individual basis rather than a per conviction basis. Because I agree with you, it does seem a little excessive to do that for an individual that would have those multiple convictions.
Okay, and one more follow-up.
So
I've just had questions. I just want to put it on the record that there's a difference between court view and what you guys do. So court view is that public-facing website. What you're charging to get rid of is those convictions that would show up on a background check, correct?
Through the chair to Representative Cologne, absolutely. The court view is the court's records management system. The state criminal history repository is the central registry for all the criminal convictions for the state. It's the state's official record. And so by statute, individuals oftentimes will have to have a particular statutory authority for them to have a background check for certain positions or for certain requirements. And they're actually called, very strangely, it's called an any person report, so that any person is entitled to this. By default, the background checks that are authorized under Alaska Statute 1262-160B8 are already somewhat limited because it does not display non-conviction information. So if a person had their charges dismissed or they were found not guilty, this information would not display on that record. If the arrests are over 100 or over 12 months old without a disposition, those also would not be displayed on the record. So by its default, it already has some limitations on that. That is going to be different than the background checks that are authorized under other statutes. For instance, dealing with children and vulnerable adults, this information would not be redacted on that. That information would still display on those because it's a different statutory authority that authorizes the background check.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Representative Hammond.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Do we have any other crimes or former crimes that, by paying a fee, don't appear in your criminal background check?
Through the chair to Representative Hannon, no.
Follow up.
Does it seem unusual that we would set up a system where twin brothers convicted of the same crime on the same day, both needing background checks, one pays the fee, they appear to have not been convicted, the other doesn't pay the fee, now they're convicted, so their background check turns up, you're not eligible to apply to be the State Trooper Academy because you have a criminal conviction. The other one, you're virtuous, can go forward. Does that seem incongruent in the systems you generally deal with?
Through the chair to Representative Hannon, it would be different than most of the background check processes that we follow. Thank you.
Okay, further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, Ms. Purinton. What we'll do is we'll do public testimony. It looks like we've only got one person online. Then we'll set an amendment deadline and adjourn for the day. So if there are any further questions for the staff or the sponsor of the bill, we're going to go over to public testimony, opening that up for House Bill 28. And a reminder for folks watching, you can submit written testimony to house.finance@akleg.gov. So with that, we've got Mr. David Morgan online. Looks like you're calling from Atlanta. Can you state your name and your affiliation and proceed with your testimony?
Yes, thank you. My name is David Morgan. I am with the Reason Foundation. Thank you for this opportunity being afforded to me. Good afternoon. My name is David Morgan, as I just stated, and I am Government Affairs Associate at Reason Foundation. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak today. 8 years after legalization, many Alaskans are still saddled with criminal records for low-level marijuana possession. A one-size-fits-all approach of lifelong criminal records simply doesn't make sense, especially considering that marijuana possession is no longer considered a crime in Alaska. Nearly 90% of employers nationwide conduct background checks on job applicants. And research suggests that job applicants with criminal convictions are approximately 50% less likely to receive a callback. To the extent that low-level marijuana possession conviction records act as a barrier to employment and make it harder for people to stay on the right side of the law, the relief provided under this bill would promote public safety while saving precious taxpayer dollars. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Morgan. Do we have any questions, committee? I don't see any questions, so thank you for calling in. So we'll go ahead and set this bill aside and set an amendment deadline for House Bill 28 for this Wednesday, May 3rd at 5 p.m. And if you do have amendments, if you can email those to my staff, Brody Anderson, by Wednesday, May 3rd at 5 p.m. Our next scheduled meeting for House Finance is tomorrow morning, again tomorrow morning at 10:30 a.m. It's May 2nd, and we'll be introducing two bills from Rep. Stapp, and that's House Bill 38, which is the appropriation limits, and also House Joint Resolution 2, which is a constitutional amendments for an appropriation limit. And before I close out, just want to make sure I close out public testimony on House Bill 28. That was the access to marijuana conviction records. So, again, 10:30 tomorrow morning for two bills on spending limit. And if there's nothing else to come before the committee, Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you remind me, on HB 66, was your amendment deadline also at 5 p.m., or was it in the middle of the day for HB 66?
For HB 66, that's the same time, Wednesday, May 3rd at 5 p.m.
Thank you.
Let me just make sure about that. Yep, Wednesday, May 3rd at 5 p.m. So if there's nothing else to come for the committee, we will go ahead and adjourn out at 3:27 p.m. Thank you.